Welcome to the latest episode of Global Class, a podcast where we explore the international expansion stories of the world's fastest growing companies and the career journeys of their globally minded leaders. My name is Klaus Wehe, and I'm here with my co-host, Aaron McDaniel.
Thanks, Klaus. In this episode, we're excited to welcome Jerry Luck. Jerry is the co-founder and president of Firework, which empowers businesses to better engage with customers through video. Prior, Jerry was head of mobile business strategy at Edmodo, co-founder and CTO of Presto, and was an early LinkedIn employee and creator of LinkedIn Mobile. In our conversation, Jerry offers insights into LinkedIn's global success, looking back on the growth of mobile technology, explains why in business today the opportunity is outside the US, why it's best to think of the progression of an expansion on a spectrum for testing new products and expanding instead of making leaps between vastly different markets, and the importance of building a diverse team while fostering common beliefs and universal core values. Awesome. Well, Jerry, thanks so much for joining us. Even though your current company is headquartered in Silicon Valley, right now you are across the Pacific in Hong Kong right now, right?
Yes. I'm in Hong Kong. I'm in one of our subsidiaries' office right now in Hong Kong. Very soon, I'm actually going to Japan in 2 weeks.
As are we, actually. Maybe we'll meet there. So would love to, maybe since you're in Hong Kong, let's take this thing full circle and go all the way back to when you were younger, growing up in Hong Kong before you started a global business journey. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you became aware? Obviously, Hong Kong is a very international place, but how did you become aware of the world beyond the island?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was born in Hong Kong in a very interesting era. You know, that's still the time that when I first born, it was still British. Hong Kong was still British colony. So I grew up with Chinese values and Western education. And culturally, Japan was very strong. So I was growing up watching Japanese anime and TV dramas, right? There was no K-pop back then. So it was all Japanese and also Hollywood movies. So it was a mix of Western culture, Chinese values, Japanese influence. It was truly, truly international. And I don't think my Chinese is not as good as people from China. Definitely our English is not as good as people from America or UK. And also, I mean, I used to speak a very little Japanese, but I mean, I think I can just say thank you right now. So we are not really, like growing up in Hong Kong, no, we're really not really good at anything, but that also gives us like a lens, like a very different perspective to see through things. But my view, international exposures was having this opportunity to come to the US for educations. I went to UC Berkeley for college, where hanging out with people and students coming from all around the world, mingling with them, and then joining LinkedIn, who is an international brand, and work with employees from all around, like the best of the best people all around the world. That gave me a lot of understanding about the whole international markets.
That's awesome. So let's dig into that LinkedIn experience as one of your first career experiences. But you were there when there were still double-digit employees, right? You were very early on, right? And credited as the creator of LinkedIn Mobile. So, you know, coming at a really interesting time when mobile was really taking off and becoming, you know, more important. But take us through that initial experience and then how that started to build into global mindset. I have to imagine even early on, there were users all over the world. And, you know, how was the company thinking about that? And it was small enough where you still could have some visibility into the founders and the executive team.
Yeah. So when I joined LinkedIn, it was about less than 40 people when I first joined at LinkedIn. So it was like quite early. In that was like end of 2004 when you joined LinkedIn. That was so-called the Web 2 era. Similar to today on Web 3, right? There's so much going on in Web 3. And back then it was all Web 2. So no one knows what's going to work with Web 2. So turns out that social media turns out is the winner of Web 2. We didn't know that. So it was fun being at the right place at the right time. So I would consider myself really fortunate to hit a few big trends in the space. So number one, definitely, is the Web 2 and social media. And then I remember when we launched, when the iPhone was unlaunched and when Steve Jobs launched the iPhone, like, we got really excited about it. But during that time, I think if you put all these people in the same, like every, this, I would say, if you put everyone believe in the mobile internet, you could probably fit them in like one conference room. That's, it was so early that people still, no one actually think can see through the potential of mobile phones. So
you mean out, the BlackBerry interface for web didn't inspire people? Is that?
No, they only think about like, you know, they don't see smartphone. I mean, okay, you can consider like BlackBerry is not that smart, but yeah, you can, if you consider that, but like in my mind, they're not that smart. They're not really the mobile internet, right? They can do emails and they basically is a better pager. And that's pretty much it with a keyboard. But, you know, no one at that time would emergence, we can have a real computer in your pockets. People still think, you know, like you can only do serious things on your desktop computer or on your laptop. The one thing about the phone, I think we were a few people that believing the mobile internet is the future. And that is really going to change how humanity is going to use technology. So we were very excited about it. But most people actually did at that time did not agree with us, but turns out to be a good bet. And that's why we try to prove them wrong. We work with Apple to launch the App Store and show you, hey, this is, we can actually do really cool things. But what fascinating about mobile is turns out that the adoptions of mobile, if you now 10 years or like 15 years after that, turns out that the mobile internet adoption is way faster internationally compared to locally in the US. Like if you look into the mobile internet and also mobile payments, it's just so much more advanced in countries like Asia compared to in the US. I think it just has to be because just like payment, right? If you think about it, why the mobile payment is so much better outside of the US? Because we have credit cards. We have a solution. It might not be the best solution at that time, but it's a decent solution. And the same thing with the computers. We are like in the US, people have computers, people have internet, they can afford one. And it's good enough. There's less reason to change that. Versus if you are in Asia, this is now they get this opportunity to start from scratch. So they can adopt a new solutions, they can jump ahead of what's the current status quo and look into the future and start building the future. And that's why we see about mobile technologies are more adopted outside of the US than before in the US. And we're still seeing trends even until these days.
Let's take maybe that experience from LinkedIn and maybe you can share a little bit more about how that sort of translated into the next role you had at Presto, right? Because you were clearly still seeing the opportunity within social networks, right? What sort of came out of your work with LinkedIn in terms of ideas then fit into that new company you're developing and building back then? Can you share a little bit more about that sort of the step from LinkedIn and then over to Presto?
What LinkedIn has done is before LinkedIn, the social relationship is limited to the in real life experience, right? So like you know somebody offline, and what LinkedIn is trying to do is they're trying to bring that relationship from offline to online. And there's a couple attempts on social network around that time, but turns out that the real identities are the key factor for social media. at least during that time. That's why Facebook and LinkedIn, which focus very heavily in view identity, turns out to be the winners of the social media. So that is taking the offline identity to online. So what we Presto trying to do is we trying to be the B2B social network that combining online and offline together. So we're trying to say, you know, from one direction, from offline to online, we're trying to see if we can actually take the relationship from online to offline. And what we did at that company was doing conferences and trade shows. You will meet a lot of people offline. So we allowed the people that going into those events, they're able to find the people to connect online ahead of the events, such that they will find the right people to talk to when they finally meet offline. So you can schedule meetings and have messages. So you're not kind of like go to the events and meet people by luck. It's a good idea. I think it was the part of was ahead of its time. I think it was at least 10 years too early. We did able to build a good, we have a good product. We have some good revenue. The company is profitable, but we didn't hit it off like a high growth company. So I think we'll be too early for that.
So I want to fast forward a little bit more to your current role at Firework. It'll be interesting maybe to the listeners to learn a little bit more about one, what Firework is as a company, then also talk a little bit more about the global nature of the business and the company, because it's sort of a not necessarily born global company, as many people talk about more, but more of a company that thinks global from day one and really are distributed across the world as a business, right? So can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So people call Firework a B2B version of TikTok. That's what they call. We don't want to call ourselves this way, but at least people claim it. So what we do is we are the decentralized version of TikTok or Instagram, right? So we allow, think about, you know, we are the Shopify live commerce and short videos. So today, you know, you can do short videos and live streaming on Instagram. And now they even have ability for you to shop there. And what we do is we take that video interactive format and put it back onto your own website or your own apps, right? So similar how Shopify allows merchants to sell on their own website. That's what we do. And when we first started, there's two things want to talk about. Number one is we started off as a global company. When we do that, we saw ourselves has more traction outside of US than in the US. I think it's because what we do is very, very mobile focused. Very, very mobile focused. And outside the US, majority of the people today, they are all the time spending or the shopping experience are all on the mobile phones. Versus in the US, a big portion of people spending time are still on desktop. So we use that, we create an index, which the index is about its number of mobile devices divided by number of desktop devices. And if you see that, you will see countries like Asia, like Hong Kong or Japan or India has the highest ratio of that versus the end of the spectrum, as you can imagine, it will be in the US. So this kind of very like vertical mobile format is being so much easier to adopt and understand from these international markets. And we are not the only company seeing this and using this approach. I'm sure you're all very familiar with TikTok. Like when TikTok starting in China, then the next big market they focus on was Japan, and then India, and then UK, and finally US. So we are the same, except we're starting from the US, but then we go all the way back into Japan and India. And that's now slowly we are seeing the adoptions in Europe and US. But we're seeing a lot of adoptions now. But you know, but moving back to 2 years ago, the outside of the US, most of our traffic was coming outside of the US. But these days, you know, it's US is our primary market.
I think this is a really cool point to highlight, is that you can't just rely on the typical criteria when you're choosing a market, right? It's not just, let's look at population growth and income and whatever. You know, the way you described that desktop to mobile device ratio, or vice versa, mobile device to desktop ratio, that's something when you really think down to it, those become really interesting indicators. And so I just want to highlight for the audience that you can think through truly what's core to your business and one of those drivers to come up with different metrics to measure instead of just the standard ones that everybody else looks at. And ultimately, it's interesting when it tells you that your market where your headquarters is not the right market to go to. And then, you know, what do you do? So maybe take us through that a little bit. So you do this analysis, you look at this custom metric as well as others, and you go, oh, okay, well, we're headquartered in Silicon Valley, but it looks like Asia, these are better markets because of this big driver. What do you do next?
Like, so what we do next is we actually use those markets as a good testing ground. Because if we are able to get adoptions in those markets, okay, let's put it this way. We know live commerce works and short videos works in China. There's no doubt about it. Let me back up a little bit and then answer your questions, right? The one question that we ask almost every day the most is, how do we see things like the live commerce and short videos? Because they have a big article last week, I believe, they're talking about, oh, TikTok tried to expand live commerce in UK and they decided to shut it down in the UK, right? So a lot of people asking, you know, like live commerce work in China so well and short videos and video commerce, it works so well in China. Does that gonna work in the US? Does it translate into the US? And the question's becoming, in our experience, we can say when something works in China, like for example, mobile technologies, is it gonna work in the US? We'll say, you know, half of that is going to work and half of that is not going to work. The question is, you don't know which half is going to work and which is not. So you just have to keep testing and have hypotheses and keep validating your hypothesis in there. So here is what we have so far figured out in this very specific questions about live commerce and short videos. The format is the right format. From all the data we have seen, you know, we are seeing tremendous amount of engagement coming for the live commerce and short videos. But when people trying to do live commerce, they're trying to just copy 100% from China and try to move it over in the US. And they try to do it exactly the same. They try to do it in the water gardens. That doesn't work. We call it, it's the right format, but in the wrong place. Because the ecosystem is different. In China, it's an ecosystem with mega apps. Almost every Chinese use, every day they spend 99% of time on 5 apps, right? Like a WeChat, like a TikTok, a Douyin, like a Kuaishou, right? Like a Alibaba, Taobao, right? There's like only 5 different apps that spend 99% of the time. They don't use the web. There's no decentralizations. And versus in the US, like in China, 99% of the time, and all of the GMV are generated within those 5 apps. Versus in the US, if you look into things like commerce or e-commerce, only less than 4% of the sales happening inside those social media mega apps. Majority of that actually happens on the websites, right? So what's working is the format on videos and live streaming and interactive and human connection. This is all working, we've seen it. But the fact that having them running inside an entertainment social media app like Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, that's not the behavior today on how people get used to. They rather, from the merchant side of things, they want to be and the consumer, they're using, they're trying to buy things on the website. So what we're trying to do is, this is why we are trying to take that format and put it back onto the website, right? Because that's what consumer wants. That's what consumer are used to. And that's also what the brands want, because they want to have their own data. They want to own their users. And data privacy is a very, very big concern in the Western market ecosystem compared to in the Chinese ecosystem, which no one actually cared too much about data privacy and how the data is being used. A very different ecosystem, very different mindset. So that will creating that. The reason why I'm talking about this is because going back to your questions about picking the market in Asia and how do we expand, is we know one spectrum is the China, is the Chinese market. And unless this is the one end of it, the other spectrum in the US. So we have to go and put the countries almost between here and keep testing it, right? Like I would say the one that closes into the Chinese ecosystem would be someone like Japan or Hong Kong. That would be more similar to this side of the spectrum. So, and then India is also part of that. So we like to test things and theory on those markets first. And then we expand it and test it into the Europe market. Actually, Europe is actually even ahead of the US. And then at the end, when everything is, it started working, then we actually go and adopt in the US. So that is the approach that we are using. Right now, hindsight is 2020. So now I'm telling you about the ecosystem, decentralization, alignment, and the website is working. Like, it's easy for us to say because it's working, but it took us almost 2-3 years to test in different markets to figure that out. And if we would have not doing this approach, we probably would not exist anymore.
That's awesome. That actually answered the question that I was going to ask before I asked it, because there is this debate, and this is something Klaus and I had seen in our research. Companies, for the most part, tend to either be successful in China or in the US, but not both. And so some of that issue might be the whale hunting of like, well, let's just go from one to the other because they're both big, and not actually thinking about it in the spectrum fashion that you just outlined. So I think that's really, really cool to actually put some structure behind that. How many countries is Firework in right now?
We cover about 150 million users around the world. I think US, like North America, Japan, India, Western Europe are our biggest markets. Also, we also have in Brazil, but now we're expanding into Southeast Asia and also Australia. The only market that we do not go to would be China.
Because of the spectrum thing you just talked about, right?
It's more than just a spectrum. It's because the ecosystem and the culture and also the political reasons is very different. China, in our mind, is almost the different universe.
So the reason I asked that is because it seems like you're kind of in the heart of this period that Klaus and I have seen where complexity can really take over. And so depending on how you approach that growth from the beginning, and if you were mindful of putting up guardrails or prioritizing speed, you know, it can create some problems. You almost have to take a step back and say, okay, hold on. We can't manage 7 different models. We need to create some scalability behind it. With that as a backdrop, how do you view complexity? How have you helped control it either from the beginning or realizing it now and actually working out ways to manage it better?
As a business, the most important thing is to survive. Let's put it this way. At a startup, we have this idea about, hey, we know that US is going to be the biggest market, right? The highest reward, right? That's what we know, that we are going to spend, if not majority, a lot of effort in the US market. But going back in time, we didn't have that luxury. We have a board that we need to report to. We need to show growth, right? So let's find a few bets on a different market and see which one's going to stick. I mean, we'll put some bet in the US, but we know that that's probably not going to stick. We'll put some, right? And at that time, we were putting the free market was India, Japan, and US, and see which one gonna stick. And we were fortunate that, you know, India turns out during that time was very good. And you can see that before the India government banned TikTok, India is number one MAU for TikTok. Those people are very video friendly in Asia. Monetization wise, I would say they're not as good compared to the US, but in terms of showing growth, it's excellent countries to pick on.
Let's connect those two things a little bit, the bets and the testing, right? I want to double click on the testing part just to understand what you guys did to test these markets out. As an example, in our book, we talk about the situation with Airbnb when they expanded into Asia. One of the things that they did was to bring Brian Chesky over to look at how users were actually using the mobile app in South Korea through a one-way mirror, testing things out and really understanding how they interact with their product. And so those type of testings of the different markets they were exploring in Asia, which was also Japan and China, sort of made them realize that, okay, if we prioritize South Korea first, the type of localization we need to make there, that can then also be translated over to the Japanese and the Chinese market. So sort of like helping you to prioritize where to go first versus later. Can you talk a little bit more about the testings that you guys made that then also help you sort of prioritize the different markets you wanted to go to? And then can you share a little bit more about that?
I think the Airbnb case is slightly different, because they already have a product market fit in the US. And for them, it's about expanding the market. For us, is we are trying to build a business, trying to find product market fit. So we have a lot of questions in our mind, is things like, is live stream or short videos commerce, does it work outside of China? Right, that's a question. That is, that's something that is a like people behavioral adoptions, or this is a ecosystem problem, right? Like meaning that, you know, it's just only the Chinese for some. It's like because only the Chinese people love to watch videos, and no one would do that, right? Is that that's the case, right? We want to kind of test that. And isolating all the different variables, we think of this couple variables that between China and US, that's like a different variables. And then we pick markets that we know that is similar to China in certain variables, and then we test those. And the other way how we difference than Airbnb is that they are pure a direct-to-consumer space, right, which means you need to really focusing on looking how people use it versus Firework. We are a B2B to C player. The advantage of us is we can talk to our customers, and it's very easy because if they pay us, we know we have a product market fit, right? So we just have to find a way to pitch the story, and we try to come up with the ideas, and we go in front of the customer and say, what do you think about this? Right? This is what do you about this business model? And the moment that would be like, oh my God, these guys pay us a lot of money, right? And I think it's working, right? Because if someone willing to give a customer, not a big enterprise, willing to afford like a five-digit, you know, revenue, like a five-digit product to pay for it every month in India, that means we must have something, right? You know, because that would mean this is much going to be much bigger in the US. That means the demand is actually very strong. So we kind of use that kind of indicators to figure out if there's any product market fit. But I think each company is different, right? Depends your B2B and if you are a B2C. I think that is very specific to us. And the other things about internationalizations is also about what products you are doing matters a lot in which countries you want to do it. Because we are very fortunate is we, our TAM, our total addressable market is huge. Basically, anyone with a website, they can use Firework. We're not limited in a specific vertical or specific area. But if you are doing products with more specific verticals or regulations, let's say payment, they're going to have much harder time to pick the market and test it because they have to go through a very lengthy process, getting approval to launch the product. Versus in Firework, you know, I mean, we talk about India and Japan, but we actually try all a lot of different markets. We deal a lot. We go to Russia, we test with Poland, we go with Germany, because for us, it's very easy and very quick to test on the market. The cost of testing and expansion is very, very low because of the nature of the product, because anyone with the website can use it, versus the other one. So I think that is a very important factor to consider when it comes to taking the approach that we are using.
It sounded like you alluded to it a little bit in your just comment here right now in terms of what impacts the business when you decide to expand it into other international markets. And sort of what we have developed is a framework that we call a business model localization canvas, where we talk about you have to run your company through two filters, where specifically we say that how government and regulation and then culture impacts the business and the business model. Can you share a little bit more about that in terms of these two specific aspects will impact Firework when you go into international markets? Do you see any regulatory challenges or any specific cultural challenges or issues when it comes to adoption of the platform in those markets?
We are fortunate in terms of video is a very universal thing. Like my 4 years old love to watch videos. And if a 4 years old, like the way how I design product is this. If you have a 4 years old that like to do something, it means that like almost like human naturally like that. So if you give her a book or a videos, she's gonna pick videos. That means that okay, people will prefer videos more than web pages. People love to watch and read. So I think culturally, we get that box check.
It is a little bit scary when it is that easy to use a product because my son was swiping by to one of the toys we had in our, what do you call that, cart on Amazon. So he basically purchased the product himself. So it's a little bit scary when it gets to that, you know, point where your kids can use the product.
Anyway. Exactly. So culture part is good. I mean, on the regulations part, I think about two things. For us, about regulations that are affecting us, number one would be data privacy. Number two, which is really big these days. Number two would be payment. Those are a lot harder in terms of doing regulation. Like they are much harder when we're thinking about international, like when we're trying to expand into international market, those two are much harder to deal with. I would still think the data privacy are slightly easier if you are being very mindful since day one, like we are, because we know we're going to hit it. And we have to make sure when we designed and build our architecture, when I work with our CTO who actually built the live commerce and content platform for Alibaba, we put a lot of thought about like what technologies that we can use to ensure we are not going to encounter big issues while we're doing the international market expansion. I think if you plan for it, it doesn't mean that you are ready for day one, but by being aware and plan for it, I think that helps you in a long way. Now when we're doing commerce, payment is a very different beast that we are still trying to navigate through. But the good things are like our product doesn't need to have everything to be able to reach the markets. It make it better, but the product is still very good, even without certain components being able to be used in those international markets.
You were talking about how, because of video being so ubiquitous across a lot of different industries, you don't necessarily run into some of the regulatory issues of like fintech companies or otherwise. But one thing that we noticed among companies that were successful at scaling globally is that they were tapping into what we label as community culture, meaning there are different pockets of people that might not specifically exist only within the borders of one country, but have a similar set of beliefs or be part of a community that goes across. And so an example that we heard about in a previous podcast episode was from Jennifer Yuen, who was a former executive at Airbnb. And they saw early on that marathon runners were a great initial entry into different markets because of the common culture they had across different borders and being adventurous and other things. So even though technically you could go in a lot of different directions when you enter new markets, did you find that there are certain types of companies that you tend to want to target more or that may be more successful, you know, fashion or some other type of businesses because of that community culture that they share across borders?
Not necessarily the culture, but more about the nature of the business and the common problems they are facing today. You brought up very good points and you actually brought up the right verticals. Our strongest customers, the verticals are the fashion and beauties, especially on the D2C brands. And they are facing it because of a global problem, less about a culture. And the global problem we are talking about is the data privacy problem. You know, recently, third-party cookies going away, and Apple, the Apple ATT, the attractions. So it make it the ads, because a lot of the D2C, they used to base on buying programmatic ads from Facebook and Google to drive their business. But now, recently, the last 6 months, the cost of acquisitions increased from about someone from 50 to 100% of those. And that is the common problem. So they are looking for a way to lower the cost of traffic. And second, in using things like live commerce and short videos to increase the conversions, and also finding ways to build connections with their customer, to build the brands and build relationship with the customer, right? That's because the other trend is those customers are also trying to afraid of the walled gardens, because they're realizing they have no control over, they don't own the users. They don't own the experience. They don't own the users. They don't own the data. So if the walled gardens decided for whatever reason increase the cost of acquisitions on the customers, they don't have any control over it because they don't own those users. And if they decided not to share the data, which they don't, they basically have nothing left on it to say, okay, what should I do next? So we are seeing, number one, a lot of the D2C brands are using, like adopting us globally in those verticals, especially they get hit the most with the ads. And we also seeing brands in the water gardens, they now trying to move out on the water gardens, such that they get a hit anyway, but for the long terms, they want to control their own future. So that's what we are seeing. So it's not about the culture, but about now is the problem. They're all seeing the same problems and leveraging as an opportunity to expand into all the different markets.
That's interesting. We see some examples of that in US markets, but it's obviously very different in China and other markets, like you're saying, where these super apps really dominate. Listening to the Indicator, the NPR podcast, and they were talking about Prime Day and how a lot of these individual sellers on Amazon, you know, they had some changes to their fee structure and it just hurt a lot of their businesses. And Amazon was able to just do it like that because they own that customer relationship. And one thing we'd love to talk to you about, and we were told in our research that this was the most difficult, but also most important element of building a global company, and that's people. And so how do you look at people, given that you're building in all these countries, how distributed is your workforce, a lot or a little, for what reasons? But how do you view that talent acquisition and that talent nurturing in different places globally?
Let's say if you have, we used to say, this, you have a mix of people, right? And they're trying to do competitions. Usually the team that is the winner, they have the most diverse team. And also the worst team, they're also the most diverse team.
It's either extreme. So I guess, what is the big difference then?
The difference between that is you want to have a diverse culture, a diverse team, but you need to have something in common to tie them together. And for us, for Firework, is our core values. So no matter which market, which countries when we're hiring, we use the same set of core values to identify and qualify people, candidates, to join Firework. And so far, we have seen, as long as they are following and like believing in those core values, we'll be able to work together as one team. And the winning and the core values that we're doing is actually four core values that we focus on. Number one is extreme ownership. So we want people come in and to feel like they're owner, and we trust them not only when they're doing the right things, but we also trust them that they will make mistakes. I think that's a very key part of it, such that people can be accountable, but they don't worry too much about, you know, making the wrong bets, because at a startup, we always fail. So that's one. The second values would be extreme speed. We focus a lot speed. We want to do it fast. We can quickly validate things. So we have a culture on quickly test an idea and looking into the data and taking risk. I think that's the second, the mindset. Third, we want to hire people that focus a lot on learn, unlearned, and relearned. So it's not just about learning, but also about unlearning and relearning. This means that people coming to here and join us, they are more open-minded people. They're understanding that things get changed. Like I said, different countries, different people, different culture. So something that works in the past or something that works in one country or one culture necessarily translate into another time. Or most of the time, it doesn't translate at all. So having that mindset of unlearning and realizing it, you know, things might be changed, might be wrong, is a very important part of it that will give us more focus on running and structuring experimentations and seeking the truth. And people more discuss about what is right than who is right. And the last values that we have is no assholes. So yeah, that's it.
I like the last one for sure, but definitely agree that core values are critical in terms of building, being that glue for the organization. We actually developed a framework in that called the Global Class Leadership Model, where we talk about company culture is sort of carrying the bridge, if you will, of the organization. You basically, with a strong company culture, that basically becomes the guiding light for decision-making for the organization, right? But then what's really important is to build trust points through the entire organization. I'm curious to understand, when you're building a distributed workforce, building trust points with teams and with people becomes a little bit harder in a virtual format. What are some of the things that you guys are doing to build trust amongst team members across the world, as they're not engaging with each other, you know, at the office and by the water cooler, et cetera?
I think since pandemic, things are very different. You know, I think what you described is not only happening between the local team and the international team. Even within the same team, we encounter similar as well. Actually, if it's one thing, it makes it in a way, it makes it actually easier than harder because of the pandemic, that actually people all working, we having a remote working environments actually make it easier to bridge the gap between international teams and the local teams. I remember the first time when we start working remotely, I asked the people who are in Europe, I say, what's the big difference? And they say, I can finally really listen clearly about what you said, because we used to having a meeting and put the computer here and we just talk, right? But now everyone is actually putting the headphones on and talking to the computer, have a microphone. It's like, wow, it's like after 2 years, I really understand, hear what you're exactly talking about, right? And now you don't no longer draw on your whiteboard that is like 15 feet away and have to guess what you're drawing. Now you're actually using electronic whiteboard. So I think that actually helps because of the pandemic. It's actually make the distance closer between all the different teams. I really love how you have the picture that you just show me. But I also want to add another dimension. But in my mind, we also add another dimension of that as well because we are a startup. So at a startup, we put it into a different stage of the company. We call it from 0 to 0.1, from 0.1 to 1, and then maybe from 1 to 100 and 100 and beyond. From 0 to 0 to 1, a lot have to do with the co-founders. The team is small, even they're international or not, you just have to carry a lot of weight on that. And between 0.1 to 1, which means say one means about 250 people or about 200 people or so, based on the team. And then from that point on, it will be based on the organization. And then after that, it will be based on the culture. That's how, like, in what we trying to think about. So that's another dimension of that. If you're just a co-founder, then yeah, international team expansion, less important. For the team, when you're in the team phrase, that becoming important. I think where your teams are, if we are serious about international global team, we're starting off even having teams leaders already outside in single area. We already have teams outside there. So to ensure we're starting off with a global mindset. And then now Firework is in the organizational stage. So we are still trying to figure out what is the right org at like a hypergrowth company and also go across in the global space. Almost every half a year, we actually have to reorg. Actually, like an hour before this in this podcast, I was actually talking to my head of people and talk about now we do this. How do we reorg it? Should we have like a local head, like regional head, or should we just, you know, have everyone reported into the same head? Doesn't matter where the regions are. We're still trying to test and experience different hypotheses. Location is not the problem. The problem is language and time zone. That's what we're understanding. It's always come down into languages and time zone. European teams are much easier for expansion. Japanese is much harder. And like Japan is interesting because we have a question in my mind. We still don't know what the answer is because most Japanese, they don't speak English. So we have a choice of we hire very good people, but we don't care about, they only speak Japanese, or we're forcing them to, we only hire people in Japan who can speak English. That would limit it, they will remove like 90% of the workforce in Japan to qualify for it. Right. So that is some questions that we have to answer. Right now, we are leaning towards, because we are not Google, we should be, yeah, let's try to see we can hire people that they don't speak English and have a regional Japan to run Japan with the team. And in countries like India, that language is not the problem. And we don't need a regional head and just have everyone just report it to the functional leaders. We don't have an answer to that. We just have to, at our phase, we just have to test and find out. There's no perfect answer. There's always pros and cons on each of that.
These are some of the things that many companies are dealing with, and also in particular with Japan, right? And how to tackle that market. And when I kind of reflect back on some of your values, I'm interested in kind of understanding how that translates to the Japanese market, because like extreme ownership individually, people typically work in teams and they make team-based decisions in Japan. Extreme speed, things are typically a little bit slower because of that decision-making process, right? And also the way that they communicate, they write long-form emails, et cetera. So I'm kind of curious on how that would translate into the Japanese market, or whether or not you actually would have to sort of adjust things a little bit to make sure that they understand how to maybe adopt some of these values, or you would have to adopt some of your practices within your organization to accommodate for that Japanese market. Do you have any sort of short comments on that?
I think it's almost like a product. It's about making trade-offs. So here is the answer. We chose to make trade-off of hiring people that may not know English in Japan, or they're not good at communicating English in Japan. But we rather pick the people who are more aligned with our values than more non-conventional people. So I think for us, the culture is more important than the language itself. And the same thing also with time zone. So if we can understanding what risk and what trade-off we are making when we make the decisions, then we're able to, everything is just experiments. You know, that's why I want to be extreme speed. If things doesn't work, we'll find it out quickly and then we'll pivot.
Awesome. Now, let's move into the last segment here, which is the three pieces of advice. So imagine, again, Jerry, that you're coming down from the elevator. You're on the fifth floor. We are asking you three quick questions, and you just have to answer them in a very, very short format. Are you ready for these three questions?
Yeah, sure.
Awesome. So what one piece of advice would you give to someone interested in building a career around international business?
Don't think too much and just do it.
Awesome. What one piece of advice do you have for a business leader expanding a business to new markets?
They have to understanding why they want to do it and understanding what trade-off are they going to make. And also, are they ready for doing it?
I think that's a great comment, because that's actually one of the first things we talk about when we talk to companies, why, and do that internal analysis as well. So I think I love that comment. What one piece of advice would you have for your younger self? The guy in Hong Kong that has yet to travel around the world, you know, what would you say to him if you met him on the streets today?
My advice to myself is don't worry too much. I think when I was in my 20s, I have a lot of anxieties. I would worry about things don't work the way that I expect it to be. Over the years, I realized my biggest learning mostly is coming from my biggest mistake. If I would not make those mistakes, I'm probably not the person that I am today. I think the biggest advice. Can I give one more advice to myself?
Of course.
The other advice is spend more time with the people that you care. You know, your kids, your family, your parents, because by the time you want to spend more time with them, you might not have that opportunity any longer. So I would advise myself to do more of that.
That one resonates a lot with me. I appreciate you sharing that. In terms of the first one you talked about, reminds me of a conversation we had with Robin Larson, where she talked about the word fail. She basically said the F is first, the A is attempt, and then I in, and then L learning, first attempt in learning. So it's a good way to kind of frame things. For when people are a little bit scared of taking those steps.
Yeah, Jerry, there were a lot of great things you talked about to highlight, from thinking of trade-offs and asking the right questions, you know, a lot of it coming to asking those right questions at the right time, using different markets as testing grounds and not forgetting to keep using that hypothesis and testing muscle and iterating muscle as you go to new countries. The importance of building a diverse team, but you need to have those common beliefs and universalized core values to help build that bridge between a distributed team. And then also those stages you talked about with growth over time, from co-founder to team to organization to culture, being what's driving things as you scale. And then one of the great mental frameworks that you outlined was just that spectrum between two vastly different markets, in your example being US and China, and how it's not about making those leaps, it's about finding those steps along the spectrum to eventually get there and leading to success. So some really great advice. We really appreciate you sharing more about your story, and we wish Firework luck not only with the reorg you're doing, but everything beyond that as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. Glad to be here.